Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Our first stop will be to finish off the Spring 2020 edition, Find Your Voice, North Carolina Government, Politics, and You. We'll be reading the From This Editor article, What Do You Think? In this issue, we talked about ways to find your voice and get involved in politics, government, and the issues that are important to you. But how do you find your voice and speak out without drowning somebody else's voice out? What do we do when friends and family don't think or believe the same way? It's not always easy. Today's North Carolinians don't always agree on issues, but politics and elections give us positive ways to express our opinions and hopes for the future. Here are some tips. Study history to understand our government and the politics of the past. Learn more. Catch up on the news so you understand both sides of the issues. Don't just talk, listen. Ask family, friends, and teachers, what do you think? Listen thoughtfully and try to understand where they're coming from. Then, think for yourself. What makes sense to you? What do you believe in your heart? And play nice. Speak out, but with respect for others. Treat people the way you want to be treated. Maybe they will begin to see your side of the story. Remember, we all deserve to be heard, so find your voice, and then get out there and discover your own way to make history. It's from the editor, Kathy East. There are a couple of photographs with this article. Here are the captions. These women took part in the 2017 Women's March in Raleigh. As the late singer Aretha Franklin sang in her 1967 hit song, they were asking for a little R-E-S-P-E-C-T, respect, in politics and government. And the other photograph, diversity is our strength in North Carolina. Collaboration and debate often spark wonderful new ideas. We can share our beliefs and learn from one another when we listen, speak, and debate with courtesy and respect. Now I'm going to read from the Fall 2010 issue, Antebellum Places. And we're going to start with Life on the Plantation at Stagville by Kimberly Purrier, who at the time that this was published was the assistant site manager at historic Stagville State Historic Site. She received her master's degree in museum studies from North Carolina State University and began her studies of antebellum plantation life during 3 years working at Mordecai Historic Park in downtown Raleigh. Close your eyes. What do you picture when you hear the word plantation? Staff members at Historic Stagville State Historic Site in Durham often ask visitors this question. Staff members hear many different responses that include words such as land, farm, crops, and enslaved people. A very large farm of at least 500 acres and at least 20 enslaved African American workers often was called a plantation. However, a simple definition for a plantation proves hard to find. An antebellum plantation ran more like a small town. It reflected an economic and social system with many complex relationships between people, the land, and the environment. Stagville, one of the largest antebellum plantations in North Carolina, included 30,000 acres of land and almost 900 enslaved individuals at its height just before the Civil War. It stretched 47 square miles, touching the modern-day Piedmont counties of Orange, Durham, Wake, and Granville. Along with thousands of acres of crops, the plantation featured mills, shops, and other common operations of the era. The story of Stagville actually began before the American Revolution. Richard Benahan, a merchant from Northern Virginia, moved to the area that is now Durham in 1768 to help manage a local store that also offered postal and banking services. His wife, Mary Amos, brought a small fortune in land and 20 enslaved people to their 1776 marriage. This partnership benefited Benahan because it boosted him from the merchant class to the planter class. Being in this top level of antebellum society meant more money, additional opportunities, and greater respect. Benahan increased his holdings by buying land and enslaved workers from small yeoman farmers. Most North Carolinians at the time could be called yeoman farmers, working the land themselves and growing little more than what their families needed to survive. These farmers sometimes owned a few enslaved people. Wealthy planters like Benahan made up less than 10% of the Piedmont's population in the late 1700s. Benahan's plantation really grew in 1787 when he bought 66 acres of land from Judith Stagg. He built the first part of what today is called the Benahan House on a hill. Another section was added just over 10 years later. Features of the house include a large hall to welcome guests, a formal parlor, a dining room, a butler's pantry, an office, and two upstairs bedrooms. The building does not have the grand white columns that most visitors driving up to a plantation would expect. The Benahan's wealth shows, however, in details like the house's paint and the glass windows imported from England. At one time, the house had other buildings such as a kitchen, smokehouse, milk house, and stable nearby. An earlier yeoman's house, possibly used by an overseer during the later Stagville era, remains on the site. The plantation truly became what we know as Stagville when Richard and Mary's daughter, Rebecca, married Duncan Cameron in 1803, combining their family's lands. Stagville reached its peak shortly after Paul Cameron, Rebecca and Duncan's son, inherited it in 1853. Richard and Mary Benahan's only son, Thomas, had no children. Paul Cameron focused on agriculture and the business of running the plantation in a way the others had not. He became known as a skilled and energetic manager, as well as a North Carolina leader in pushing for improvements in farming. During the antebellum period, enslaved people were legally considered property. Most people viewed owning slaves and land as the way to advance in society. The Benahan Cameron family became one of North Carolina's wealthiest families before the Civil War through its land and the laborers who worked that land. The enslaved people at Stagsville labored 6 days a week. While Sunday was supposed to be a day of rest, the slaves often spent that time working in their own gardens to provide more food for their families. They received rations of cornmeal, flour, molasses, and sometimes dried pork. This diet differed greatly from that of a planter family, which regularly enjoyed a variety of meats, bread, fruits, and vegetables. By the time they were 8 years old, the majority of the enslaved residents of Stagville were involved in growing cash crops. A cash crop is harvested to sell for money rather than for personal use. Tobacco, cotton, and other crops grew on the plantation. But the site's main cash crops included corn, wheat, and rye. Trees cover the land today and block the view from the slave quarters to the main house. But when Stagville was a working plantation, open land and fields stretched for miles and miles. The Southern Historical Collection at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill now preserves thousands of Benahan Cameron family business and personal papers, everything from wills and tax bills to love letters. Paul Cameron kept detailed records and accounts of almost all the enslaved people that he owned, what jobs they had, when they got married, when they had children, and even when they died. Such documents help researchers piece together the story of the enslaved community. Many documents list only first names of the slaves. For years, the Stagsville staff has been working to compile a genealogy and full names of the plantation's enslaved laborers and their descendants. This project involves evidence such as the oral history and family traditions of the slaves' descendants, as well as documents. Compared to many southern plantations, researchers have recovered much information about Stagsville's enslaved community. A great deal remains to be learned. We do know that working the land was not the only labor performed by the enslaved residents of Stagsville. Slave artisans such as Lewis, a blacksmith, designed and repaired tools. Ben, a cobbler, made shoes for the planter and enslaved families. In one 1848 letter, Cameron writes that Ben S., our tanner, died very suddenly last week in a congested chill. Poor fellow. He had but a short notice, and every effort was made by Dr. Hicks and myself to save him. He died perfectly himself and was as cold as clay for 3 hours before he breathed last. A great loss to us and to his fine young family. Enslaved carpenters and masons built and repaired plantation buildings. A cooper called Old Man Cox made wooden buckets. Gardeners worked in the kitchen garden. And stable hands took care of the horses and carriage houses. Peggy was a spinner who spun cotton into thread. Abner could then weave this thread into cloth. Abner made sheets, blankets, potholders, and clothing. If anyone became ill, there was a nurse, Christiana, who took care of them. Daniel was the Cameron family's carriage driver. Whether they were field hands, artisans, or house workers, enslaved laborers toiled from sunup to sundown. They did not receive pay. They enjoyed no vacations. They rarely, if ever, could leave the plantation. And they faced a range of restrictions and punishments. The planter controlled almost everything about the workers' lives. In the evenings, though, the enslaved people could spend time with family and friends. They could develop relationships within the large Stagsville slave community and foster an appreciation for their heritage. None of the enslaved laborers at Stagsville came directly from West Africa, but all their ancestors did. West African traditions like communal cooking continued. Families gathered at night outside the slave quarters and cooked together, sharing what they had grown in their gardens. Music was another West African tradition that the people continued. Singing served as an outlet for sharing sadness or joy. Slave songs sung on plantations became today's gospel music. Several popular American instruments like the banjo have roots in African culture. Visitors to historic Stagsville often ask whether the Camerons were kind slave owners or whether they frequently punished their slaves. From reading primary documents in the family papers, researchers know that Camerons did care for their slaves, probably for economic as well as personal reasons. They made sure the workers had decent food and clothes. Many of the letters that Paul Cameron's wife Anne wrote to him discussed the health and physical well-being of the enslaved people. Cameron very likely saw himself as a kindly slave owner. Antebellum white people in general, though, believed that they were naturally smarter and better than the enslaved people were. Most documents that survive were written by the Benahans and Camerons themselves. In fact, North Carolina passed legislation in 1830 banning anyone from teaching a slave to read or write. This law helps prevent today's historians from getting a clear view of the institution of slavery from the eyes of those who were enslaved. It is difficult to answer questions about physical punishment. Punishments differed from plantation to plantation, but there had to be some system set in place to keep people enslaved against their wills. None of the Cameron papers that are known to historians discuss punishment at Stagsville. They do mention beatings that happened on other property that the family owned in Mississippi and in Alabama. School groups visiting Stagville often ask another complex question. Why didn't the slaves just run away? Running away was dangerous and difficult. Runaway slaves traveled by foot, rarely had money, and did not know whom they could trust. They were surrounded by white males with weapons and horses, alert to any hint of slave rebellion or escape. Getting caught meant severe penalties like whippings, being sold away from one's family, possibly to another state, and even death. Enslaved individuals had to think about leaving others behind. A large group was easier to notice as missing and to spot. It would have been even more difficult, almost impossible, for an entire family to leave at once. Even if a runaway reached the North, freedom was not guaranteed. Again, law reinforced the institution of slavery. For example, Congress passed the Fugitive Slave Act as part of the Compromise of 1850. This act required all runaway slaves to be returned to their owners. While the enslaved people worked on the plantation, the planters themselves often were away attending to business. Life on a plantation would have been lonely and isolated for white women. The closest town to Stagville was Hillsboro, about 18 miles away. In the antebellum era, it would have taken about a half a day to travel there. Planter women were discouraged from having relationships with the enslaved people working in and around the house. Despite their wealth, these women usually did not go away to school. Tutors were brought into the home for boys until they became older and attended schools like the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Girls learned skills that were considered proper for wealthy ladies at the time, such as reading, sewing, music, and languages like French. The Benahan and Cameron wives and daughters did carry out many jobs to make the plantation run smoothly. They often worked from sunup to sundown, too, managing the work of slaves, entertaining business and personal guests, gardening, preserving fruits and vegetables, mixing medicines, and making candles, soaps, rugs, and linens. History books and documents offer a great deal of data about the antebellum period, but a wealth of information exists at Stagville itself. The site today includes 162 acres and several structures. Visitors can get a sense of how enslaved people lived, for example, by going into an original slave quarter built in the 1850s. Four of the original slave quarters still stand, a rarity in North Carolina. Why do you think so many plantation houses survived, but slave quarters do not? These two-story structures were built to ward off sickness. Slave houses that had been constructed in 1823 had dirt floors and thatch roofs that allowed in water and rodents. Multiple slave families lived in one building, therefore sickness spread very quickly. Visitors can see the changes that were made in the later structures. The roofs were made with cedar, for example. Each quarter has four rooms. A family shared one room, meaning about 30 people lived in one structure. Stagville visitors can note the differences between the slaves' houses and the Benahan house, including the design, the size, and the artifacts inside. And they can eye the work of the enslaved people that remains. A chimney bears marks from the fingers of the brick masons. The great barn has axe marks visible on its wood. Enslaved people designed and built it in the summer of 1860. History has been found under the ground at Stagville, too. Archaeologists uncovered a cowrie shell on a remaining domestic slave quarter foundation. This was an important find. This kind of shell cannot be found on the east coast of the United States. In fact, the kind of shell discovered at Stagville can only be located on the west coast of Africa. One of its main uses there was as currency. However, since none of the enslaved people at Stagville came directly from West Africa, the cowrie shell must have been passed down from generation to generation. Its discovery tells historians that the enslaved people had been holding on to parts of their African heritage. Today, Stagville offers a wealth of information, from primary documents to structures. Descendants of the people who once lived there often visit the site, take the tour, and teach the staff. And as a result, History continues to come alive. Here are captions for the photographs that accompany this article. The Benahan House was built just before the antebellum era. By the time of the Civil War, the Benahan-Cameron family was one of North Carolina's wealthiest. This cowrie shell was discovered on the remaining domestic slave quarter foundation, located just behind the house. The shell originally came from West Africa, where it was likely used for currency. These bricks are part of the only original chimney on the grounds of Stagville today. Four finger marks appear along the bottom of the central brick where it was pulled from its mold. Enslaved African Americans made bricks with native clay soil. They put the clay into wooden molds to dry in the sun, and then pulled the bricks out for firing in a kiln. Because of the high demand for bricks on the plantation, the workers often did not have time to let the bricks dry completely, making it more likely that they would leave marks behind. Anne Ruffin, daughter of North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Thomas Ruffin, wore this white cotton, organdy, and satin dress for her wedding to Paul Cameron in 1832. Visitors to historic Stagville State House, State's historic site in Durham, can view the inside of a slave home and the inside of the Benahan House to get a sense of the different ways that antebellum North Carolinians lived. A family of 5 to 7 enslaved African Americans probably lived in the single room pictured. The adults likely would have slept in a bed in one corner, with children sleeping on small pallets on the floor. The Planter family ate in the pictured dining room with its detailed, expensive woodwork, just one of several large rooms in the house. Enslaved people fixed the family's meals in a separate kitchen building. The unusual two-story, four-room slave cabins in the Horton Grove section of historic Stagville State Historic Site were built in the 1850s. During the antebellum era, each room housed a family of enslaved workers. There is also an October 1854 quote from Paul Cameron in an address before the Orange County Society for the Promotion of Agriculture, the Mechanic Arts, and Manufactures. "Seek to make your homes lovely, especially in the eyes of your children. Induce them to aid you in ornamenting it. Children employed and happy at home are the best guarantee for virtue and devotion to parents. No cottage so humble that it may not be made sweet by neatness, none so lowly that it may not be embellished by the hand of industry. No man is so poor but that he can contribute something to make our world more beautiful. He can leave behind him monuments of his good sense and of his refined taste, if not his opulence. He who plants a tree, sets an orchard, or builds a stone barn may be longer and better remembered than he who dies a millionaire. The rose or the jessamine at the door of a homestead, or the lily of the valley at the grave of a friend, is quite as certain an indication of a pure heart and gentle feeling as gilded walls and silver plate or chiseled marble. Surround your dwellings by fruitful and well-kept gardens. No man is better entitled to all the good fruits of the earth than he who tills it. Money is as much the sinew of agricultural improvement as it is of war. Capital nowhere makes a more sure return than when judiciously applied to agricultural improvement." Next is an Tar Heel Junior Historian Essay Contest winner, Ellie Revels, who at the time won first place in the intermediate division of the Tar Heel Junior Historian Essay Contest of 2010. She was at the time a seventh grade member of the Homeschoolers Unfolding North Carolina History, Public History of Johnston County, Public Library of Johnston County, and Smithfield, Elaine Foreman advisor. The contest asked students to write an imaginary letter home from a delegate to North Carolina's 1835 Constitutional Convention, addressing key issues, decisions, and other topics. Judging criteria included historical accuracy, complete response to essay prompt, originality, use of properly documented primary and secondary resources, and technical writing skills such as grammar and structure. July 2, 1835, my dear family, I hope this letter finds you all in good health. I trust it shall not be long before I am with you again. This convention can be tiring at times. Though many problems have been resolved, the constant arguing or debating, as some call it, wears on one's nerves. The first day we assembled was June 4th. We meet every morning at 9 on weekdays, and on Saturday we assemble at 12 o'clock. Every morning a prayer by a Protestant preacher opens our day. Nathaniel Macon was elected president of this convention. He is a great influence here. Delegates from the western part of the state are trying to get equality in the House of Commons and the Senate, which is one of the reasons the convention has come about. Besides the fact that our old Constitution was not able to govern us and it could not be amended. Also, we in the East had control of the government for so long, but the West finally succeeded in having this convention held. We did in the end give in to their wants about representation in the House. I had the pleasure of meeting Governor David L. Swain for the first time last week. He, as you know, worked hard to get this convention together. Many things have changed. One of the articles we revised was to take away the borough representation. Also, there has been debate on Article 32, which states that only those who hold to the Protestant faith would qualify to hold office. One of Craven County's delegates, Mr. William Gaston, a devout Catholic, gave a two-day speech on allowing every religious and non-religious person to hold office. He succeeded in changing the wording from Protestant to Christian, but nothing more. My opinion is partly with Mr. Gaston. I think a man should be able to serve our state, but he should believe in God. Last night I had dinner with Jesse Adams, my comrade and fellow delegate from Johnston County, and with Mr. Gaston. He confided with us that he had the idea of honoring our state with a song called the Old North State. Representation has changed in many aspects. The House of Commons will have 120 members and the Senate 50. The Senate members will be elected from districts of people who pay equal amounts of state tax and who own at least 50 acres of land. The House will contain at least one delegate from each county. The exact numbers will be determined by federal population. The governor, instead of serving an annual term, will be voted on by male taxpayers for a two-year term. I hope the response from the people will be in favor of these new changes, though I am inclined to believe that the East will not take kindly to losing some of its power. We have debated on whether the free Negroes will lose their vote. It was decided they would. This, I must admit, I do not agree with. Another thing we resolved was to have the committee report the business of the convention. After debating whether we should employ a printer to print the new and resolved Constitution, we have settled upon Joseph Gates and Son. Things will be indeed changed everywhere. I believe everyone should be satisfied, for indeed the business of government is compromised. Sincerely, Hillary Wilder. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.